Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
How about them Chiefs?
How about those Chiefs?
Well, actually, I've got two things to say. How about them Chiefs? And how about them temps? Holy crap, that was cold. I do not care what the thermometer said yesterday. It may have said 15. It may have said 12. It felt like negative 50 on the field. I mean, seriously, I thought that my jaw was going to lock up and fall off during the pregame show. And if it did, it would have shattered into a million different pieces on the ground. That's how cold it was. I put my jaw on the ground. So nothing but respect for the Chiefs fans who showed up the way they did for that game and partied the way they did throughout. In fact, quick side note. So the show that I was a part of, the NFL on CBS, was starting at 12 noon. We tried to get there at 8 a.m. to get ready for the 12 noon show. Our bus, which was traveling the team, our team, showed up at the stadium at 7:30. You would not believe how long the line was to get in already. Chiefs fan was lined up to get into the stadium at, I mean, I don't know, 7 a.m. for a 2 o'clock game. I mean, that literally was the coldest event I've ever been a part of. And they were trying to get there 5, 6, 7 hours early in order to then endure 4 more hours of sub-freezing temperatures. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I could not be more impressed by the Chiefs and the fans and what I saw, and especially one Chief in particular, Travis Kelce, who channeled the Beastie Boys.
I'll tell you what, it's been 7 years coming, baby. I learned one thing since I've been here. You gotta fight for your right to party!
My man is incredible. That was incredible. He's incredible. And then he busted into the Patrick Mahomes post-game interview in order to say this.
Every single time you get on the field.
The best quarterback in the National Football League right here, baby. And he shows it every time. Humble as can be, baby. I love you.
No, it's awesome. You think that guy was very fired up? You think Chiefs Kingdom was fired up? You think this guy is fired up?
Fired up. Fired up to go to Miami. Need to get on a diet so I can fit in my clothes so we can go do our thing. But very proud.
Love it, coach. Everybody right now is starting their Super Bowl crash diet, including the big man, Andy Reid. So Kansas City's going back to the Super Bowl for the first time in 50 years, a half a century. Now, don't tell me you weren't sweating it early on, because I know you were, Chiefs fans. The grip was strong because the Titans came out and they did exactly what you thought they would do. They fed the ball to Derrick Henry. And sure enough, they get out to a 10-0 lead. And it felt like that boa constrictor was starting to wrap. I said it as I was freezing on the field yesterday. The one thing the Chiefs did not want to do was fall behind big like they did a week earlier. Coming back on the Texans was one thing, but you were not going to be able to do that against the Titans. Not when they could just pound it with that big dog. Not when they could let him just move the chains, spin clock, and abuse fools. That was a sure recipe for disaster for the Chiefs. Now, going down 10-0 to Tennessee is not the same thing as being down 24-0 to the Texans, but it was trending in that direction because Tennessee can eat clock like nobody else, and KC's defense was helping out with one penalty after another. So I know you were tripping, Chiefs fans. You can admit it. I get it. You had been down that road so many times before, and you had been burned so many times before, and it looked like it was going to happen again. So I know you were losing your mind when Tennessee went on that 15-play, 75-yard drive that took 9 minutes and 7 seconds off the clock. It included multiple penalties, and then it was capped off with this.
One running back in a three-point stance. That's Henry under center. Tannehill fakes the handoff, throws a short pass. It's caught in the end zone by Dennis Kelly, an offensive lineman, an extra lineman. The backpedaling two-handed catch by the lineman, Dennis Kelly. It's a touchdown pass, a short one, by the quarterback, Ryan Tannehill.
Westwood won on the call. F-G-T-D, baby. F-G-T-D. Except that was not a fat guy touchdown. Dennis Kelly is 6'8", 321. So that's no fat guy touchdown. That is a large, athletic man touchdown. And a hell of a play call from Titans offensive coordinator Arthur Smith, somebody that Jason Lockenfor and I spoke about on the NFL on CBS. Now, at that point, the grip in KC was a kung fu death grip, because this is exactly what the Titans had done to everybody else in the last 3 weeks. They crack you in the jaw, then they drive you in the ground on long drives, and then they score on a soul-snatching gadget play. Except, KC came back. They scored. They made it 17-14. And then with seconds to go before halftime, the play that completely changed that game.
Mahomes moving to his left laterally, chased, holding it, and gets out of bounds and up the sideline. He's not out of bounds yet. He's at the 10, inside the 10. He dives for the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City. A remarkable acrobatic scramble on a 27-yard run.
KC Radio, not exactly a tackling clinic by Tennessee, but that was not about what Tennessee didn't do. That was all about what Pat Mahomes did do. This guy just kept on fighting, and he absolutely was not going to be taken to the ground. The thing about Pat is, you know, he brings crazy skills and athleticism, but what he does not get enough credit for is that legendary toughness. He's got the toughness to match. This dude is a savage. This is the guy who saw his kneecap lined up in the wrong spot, had to pop right back into place, and then tried to re-enter the game. That's a guy who felt the pain of losing last year in the AFC Championship game, so he went to school on it. He was not going to let that happen again, especially in his house. And that's a TD that is going to be remembered for a very long time. It was awesome. Part of a 28-0 run that flipped that game from being down 17-7 to up 35-17, and that's what that Chiefs team can do. You think you've got the lead, you think you're playing your game, and then in a matter of minutes, that game is turned upside down, and suddenly you're playing their game. Suddenly you're getting hammered. Am I right, Titan fan? Yesterday was an answer for all of you who thought that maybe Patrick Mahomes had taken a step back, that maybe last year was an anomaly, that he was not that good. Not that good. Fact is, he is that good. No, he's better. I don't give a damn what the numbers say. He's better, and he proved it again yesterday. 23 of 35, 294 through the air, 3 touchdowns, 53 yards, and a TD on the ground. And he made it look easy, seriously easy. Some of those runs were the easiest runs you're ever going to see a quarterback make. Some of those passes were just a joke. Don't take it from me. Ask Travis Kelce, quote, who he is right now and how he's been able to take the scrutiny and take the hype and just be himself and ball. That's a special trait that he has in life. I'm just happy I get to play with him. End quote. He nailed that. That's exactly what that is. We should all also be happy that we get to watch him, because that's a generational talent. That's greatness in action. That's an unbelievable player and an unbelievable dude. And unless he's carving your team, how can you not get with him? You got a problem with Pat Mahomes. You have a much bigger problem with yourself. And how about this? How about a little bit of love for that much maligned Chiefs defense? Because they dominated in the second half. Yes, the offense was putting up numbers, but the KC defense shut the Titans down. Do you remember the buildup to the game? Do you remember what KC defensive end Frank Clark said about Derrick Henry? Remember that? Clark said, quote, he's not hard to hit. He's just a big guy, 240, 245, 250. Honestly, he should be running harder at his weight and at his size. I don't see no difficulty in tackling him. He's just easy to me up front, because I don't look at any running back like they can't be tackled. He's not one of the best guys at breaking tackles, to me, honestly. End quote. So he said that, and it seemed like such a bad idea. Everybody freaked out. He said it. Everybody said he screwed up. He gave them bulletin board material. And it's true. Everybody who said that before him had paid a price. Earl Thomas said something like that, and Derrick Henry used that against him. Actually, Derrick Henry used Earl Thomas against the Ravens. Frank Clark said it, and then he and the rest of that defense backed it up. I don't want to see they made it look easy, but they kind of made it look easy. And after that first half, they locked up Henry and the Titans offense, and Frank Clark was the guy who sealed the game with a big sack.
They snap it just in time to avoid a delay of game. Tannehill under pressure, still moving to his right. Frank Clark chasing, knocks it down. Tannehill goes down. Shark-infested waters. Frank Clark, the shark, has just given Kansas City its first trip to the Super Bowl.
Get out of the water. Get to the beach. Frank Clark, the shark. All right, so let's talk about a common problem for just 1 minute. The one thing that health experts, dietitians, athletes, and even top performers all seem to agree upon is the perfect diet simply does not exist. Even with a balanced, healthy diet, it can be so hard to cover all your nutritional bases through food alone. This is why there is Athletic Greens. The Athletic Greens Ultimate Daily All-in-One Health Drink has 75 proven vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients, which make it easier for you to get that comprehensive nutrition without the need for a bunch of pills, powders, and complex routines. What I'm saying is, it is the most complete supplement for a better you. And it's different from anything else I've ever tried. It's different because it's delivered in powder form and it's mixed with water. Athletic Greens requires fewer capsules. It has superior absorption. It does not include any binders or fillers. One scoop of Athletic Greens provides a convenient, affordable, and tasty solution to fill the gaps in your diet. So if you're looking to boost energy, strengthen your immune system, or support gut health, this is the perfect product for you. Whether you're taking steps towards a healthier lifestyle or you're an athlete pushing for better performance, Athletic Greens takes the guesswork out of everyday good health. Why not try it? Jump on over to athleticgreens.com/Rome. Claim my special offer right now. 20 free travel packs valued at $79 with your first purchase. athleticgreens.com/Rome. Go now, Tanny! Get to the beach, Tanny! And they chase that with a Conor McGregor strut. And like Connor, Clark had something that he wanted to say when it was all over.
Past two games, each game, 70 yards, over 200 yards each game. I know damn well we weren't going to win the game if we let that happen. They come in here, he ran for 70 yards, they call him the best rusher in the league. We're sitting in this home early.
I posted the comments that you said to me, and all over social media, everybody said you better watch your back, that you're saying things that you can't cash. Everybody on social media saying, back.
They must not know who I am yet. They gonna find out sooner or later when I got that ring on my finger. At the end of the day, we champions. AFC, that trophy that got my own the last name on it, that's the KC. That's KC. Ain't no fall off. Last year, jump off sides, all that. I told them when I got here, this gonna change. Look at this. We're the best in the world.
Go join.
My man was feeling it. We're sending his bleep home early. Talked junk before the game and then backed it up during the game. Maybe not exactly Bart Scott, but damn, that's not far off. He and his crew made one hell of a statement. I know the offense is going to get a ton of run, and they deserve every bit of it, but that Chiefs defense is different than some of the ones in the past. They can make plays. They can win you games. Quote, the best bleepers in the world. I could not have been more impressed with what I saw from that team and their fans. See y'all in Miami. One game away, KC. One game away from winning your first Super Bowl in 50 years. One game away from everybody putting the proper respect on Andy Reid's name. And more importantly, one game away from Travis or Frank challenging T's older bro at the podium.
No one likes us! No one likes us! No one likes us! We don't care!
It's 7 years coming, baby. I learned one thing since I've been here.
You gotta fight for your right to party!
Damn, that family. Unbelievable. Terrell Davis is my guest. Terrell, good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, always a pleasure to be on your show, man. How you doing?
Good to have you, TD. I'm doing great. Thanks for coming back on. You know, going into yesterday's game, Derrick Henry and the Titans were running over everybody in their path. He broke your record for most rushing yards in his first four postseason games. So what did you think as you watched him in the first two playoff games?
I mean, it was incredible. You talked about it. Every time I turned on the TV, he was breaking one of my records. So super impressive. You know, he's a big guy. It's not like he's a little scat back. You're talking about a guy that's 250 pounds but runs like a scat back, has real good patience, can break a lot of tackles, and gets stronger as the game goes on. I thought that was the perfect formula for Tennessee, but obviously, to be able to do that, you need some other help, right? You need the quarterback to play well. You need the defense to play well. And I think Henry carried that team as far as he can take them.
Terrell Davis joining us right now. You know, so he and the Titans seem to make it work going early on, but then Kansas City started to find itself. They started to click on offense, and then Pat Mahomes had that TD run right before halftime. In fact, what did you make of that run?
Yeah, it was a backbreaker. You know, they gave up that long run. They had the play defense well, but you tend to forget about Patrick Mahomes and how he can use his legs. And he used his legs on that. He kind of tight-roped the sideline and stayed in balance. And then the last 5 yards, he got physical and scored a touchdown. And I think, for me, when I saw that, that was kind of like the tipping point where it's like, I don't think the Titans have a chance now because that crowd was into it. The players were into it. You got your quarterback doing that. That's like when I saw John Elway do the helicopter in Super Bowl 32. It gives you a sign that I think we're going to win this game. And they felt that.
Hall of Famer Terrell Davis joining us. So when you see him running around like that, and you already know what he can do with his arm and the weapons he has around him, if you're an opposing defense, how exactly do you go about trying to stop Mahomes?
Yeah, I think the Niners have the – I guess you got to have the pieces. And I think the Niners have the pieces. They've got a very active front. Nick Bosa, you know, DeForest Buckner, Armstead, they've got a lot of talent. D4, they've got guys that can get after Patrick Mahomes. I think the key there is trying to keep him in the pocket and then try to cover those windows up where he can't see where those lanes are. But it's easier said than done because the guy's like, you know, he's like Houdini. The minute the ball is snapped, he's going to go to his first, second, third, fourth read, and he's going to make something happen. So the Niners have to be disciplined, but they have to get after him and put some pressure on him.
Terrell Davis joining us courtesy of LG today. We'll get to that in a minute. So when you have the 49ers and they're rushing the way they are and they've got that blocking clinic that they put on yesterday, when you watch Kyle Shanahan's 49ers, how much do they remind you of his dad's Broncos?
A lot. I played in an offense, so I know how running back friendly it is. But it's really everybody being a part of the run game. You know, you're asking the tight ends to block, George Kittle's blocking. You're asking the wide receivers to block. What's different about this offense, though, is that the variety of runs that they have. You know, when I was playing, we used mostly some zone. We did some gap and man blocking as well. But they're doing it with receivers and Deebo Samuels and all these kind of shifts and motions and all these jet sweeps. They keep the defense off balance with that, and then are running the football behind that. So a little different than the offense I ran in, but I think the mindset is the same, and Kyle Shanahan understands that if they're going to have success on this level and this time of the year, they have to run the football.
Now, in terms of Kyle Shanahan, you've actually been praising him for a long, long time, well before he had this dominant season. What have you seen from him that makes you believe that he is truly special?
You know, I've been around him, I mean, basically his whole professional coaching career. And he was, again, he's Mike Shanahan's son, so he was around the facility when he was a young man. And I spent time with him in Washington when Mike Shanahan was the head coach. I was doing an intern there, and Kyle Shanahan was the offensive coordinator. So I had a chance to see him work. I had a chance to see him be a leader in front of the team, you know, lead men. And then just his brain. It's different how he puts the offense together and the twist that he puts on it and how he can see a defense and attack the weaknesses. I've seen it firsthand. So that's why I think he can be special.
Terrell Davis joining us. You know, Raheem Mostert, of course, is like this amazing story. I mean, six other teams had given up on this guy, and then he went historic yesterday. As one running back watching another, what's going through your head when you see him breaking off the runs that he broke off yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, I think I put out a simple tweet yesterday. I was like, Raheem Mostert is balling. I mean, I know that's not creative, but I was just, you know, he had 100 yards in the first half. And I remember being a part of games like that when you have a ton of yardage before you even hit the halftime. And you start thinking about rarefied air and, like, legendary, you know, performances. And I think he was thinking about that. He came through, he carried his team to a win, and now they're in the Super Bowl.
All right, so he was an excellent special teams player, in fact, still is. Yeah. Of course, you had that legendary special teams tackle against the Niners in Japan.
Yeah.
Take me back, TD, what do you remember about that play?
That's called the hit. I've coined that play, it's called the hit. You got the catch, right? You got all that stuff, but that's the hit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what I remember was that was the play that launched my career. It was the one that got, you know, the coaches to notice who I was, my teammates noticed who I was, and I just took advantage of an opportunity that really wasn't there. You know, I wasn't supposed to be on special teams, and they called me in, and I was trying to prepare myself to make a splash, And I remember just going down there. I knew I had to be the first one down, and it was Tyrone Drakeford. And I said, I got to make a play. And went down there and hit him, made a nice form tackle. It was actually a textbook tackle, too, by the way. My head was to the side, hit him with my shoulder, picked him up, and made a really good tackle.
It was perfect. And it was the ultimate splash play. Now, the thinking is, TD, if you were preparing for that moment, you probably had to be eating the right food that day, right? What did you eat that day? Clean burning fuel?
No. You know what? I didn't think I was going to play in that game. So I ended up eating a bunch of hot dogs in the third quarter because I thought, you know, the starters were out, and I figured I wasn't going to play, so I was hungry at the time. I figured I'd enjoy some of this delicious sideline food, and I ended up eating hot dogs and went in, and after I ran out on the kickoff to make the tackle, I went to the sideline, and my coach saw me over there. I was throwing up hot dogs, and he was asking me about whether I was good to go in on the next series to be a running back. And I was like, "Listen, nothing's gonna keep me out this game." But yeah, I didn't eat the right food, and so that's a lesson to all my kids out there. Make sure you eat the right food.
That is amazing. Terrell Davis joining us. All right, so really quickly, we've got 2 weeks to talk about the Super Bowl, but what are your early thoughts on the matchup?
My early thoughts is, I mean, the Niners look so good. Just, you know, obviously on the defense side of the football, that front is just, they're rejuvenated. They're healthy. They're back. You know, D Ford is back. Nick Bosa is just, the guy is just incredible. And they're putting a lot of pressure on quarterbacks. And Robert Saleh, the defensive coordinator, he understands when to blitz, when not to blitz, and it's helping out the back end. Their offense, listen, they're not throwing the ball a whole lot. Jimmy Garoppolo is not throwing the ball 8 times, 6 completions. But they ran the ball like that. They have the ability to morph into whatever they have to. Kansas City, they had to overcome some deficits. I like their offense. I like the explosiveness. But I'm still concerned about their defense. We'll have the Niners slightly ahead of them right now.
Let's instead take a moment and reflect on what happened yesterday in Santa Clara. Because while there was some tension and some drama in the AFC Championship game, there was none of that in the NFC Championship game. And for all the talk that the regular season blowout would not matter, the first 3 quarters of yesterday felt like a carbon copy of that regular season blowout. The Niners come out and they simply opened up a can on Green Bay. That was an absolute clinic on all sides of the ball by the 49ers. And I don't want to say that Green Bay lost that game. When they decided to punt on 4th and short from midfield on their opening possession, but Green Bay pretty much lost that game when they decided to punt on 4th and short from midfield on their opening possession. It was pretty much over at that point because San Francisco went pass, run, pass, run, pass, and then this.
Garoppolo in the shotgun along the left hash, gives to Mostert. Mostert has a hole. Mostert at the 30, turns on the Jets up the left sideline, inside the 10, inside the 5, and a touchdown. He slides and swims through the back of the end zone in celebration after a 36-yard touchdown burst to give the Niners a 6-0 lead.
That's Westwood 1. 7-0 Niners, and that was the start of that beatdown. And honestly, one of the most badass play calls that you're ever going to see. Truly. A running play. At this time, in this league, a running play on 3rd and 8 from the Green Bay 36. That right there is not just a play call. That's a statement, an emphatic statement. 3rd and 8 is a passing down. For most coaches, 3rd and anything more than 3 is a passing down. That wasn't even a draw play. Kyle Shanahan is a wizard. I'm still blown away by that call and by the execution on that call. And that was just the start of a monster game from Raheem and the offensive line and pretty much anybody wearing red. Raheem was on this show a few weeks back, and we talked about how he had been cut by 6 different teams. And then the guy rushes for 220 yards and 4 TDs in the NFC Championship game. And there was nothing fluky about that either. It wasn't like some defensive breakdown where he broke off a couple of 90-yard runs and then was just average and mediocre for the rest of the game. This guy was running hard and fast the entire game, carrying the load the entire game. He's got a list on his phone of the teams that cut him and the dates that they cut him. Now he's got the record for most rushing yards in a conference championship game. This is a guy who was one of the best special teams players in the league and then got the opportunity and just turned in one of the greatest rushing performances in league history. It's amazing. And he tied for the team lead in receptions with 2. with two, which brings up another point. In this era of the NFL, how do you explain winning an NFC title in a game where your quarterback completes six passes while attempting just eight? Jimmy Garoppolo went more than an hour and a half without even throwing a pass, which is just stupidity, right? Green Bay knew what was coming and still couldn't do a damn thing to stop it. This is because Shanahan was dialing up plays like a wizard, the offensive line was rolling, and George Kittle was putting on the kind of blocking display the coaches dream about. Like, just take his clips, slap them on a VHS, and sell them for three easy installments of $29.99 plus shipping and handling. As Kittle told Mike Silver after the game, blocking is, quote, my favorite part of football. Moving a man from point A to point B is the greatest feeling you'll ever feel. You've just got to trust me. There is nothing better than that bleep. Our coaches said before this game, we're going to run it till they stop it. So we did, and they didn't stop it. And we kept running and running some more. End quote. Not yet. And then he shows up to meet the media wearing a t-shirt of a shirtless Jimmy G on that shirt.
So you remember Jimmy had a t-shirt with my face in his locker, and he told everyone I sent it to him. I got this in my locker the same day. I just didn't show you guys because I was saving it for a special occasion. So I think it's pretty good. He even signed it.
That is a special occasion. That is pretty good. In fact, the Niners are pretty good. And here's another detail about the 49ers that you probably already know, but even if you do, it bears repeating. The San Francisco 49ers beat the living crap out of you on both sides of the ball all game. They didn't throw the ball because they didn't need to throw the ball. They can, they have, they will again, but they don't need to beat you because they'll knock you on your ass. The only guys who aren't killing it as blockers are the guy who hands off the ball to the guy carrying the ball. The other nine guys are putting dudes in the ground. And on defense, they'll beat the crap out of you there too. Don't look at the final stats because that game was over at halftime. Green Bay studied what happened after the regular season meeting. They came up with a new game plan and got the exact same results. They had 93 yards in the first half. They went 0 for 4 on third down, and they had a pair of turnovers. And the 49ers pass rush was all over Aaron Rodgers time and time again, just like they were the first time they met. There were stretches where it looked like there were 15 pass rushers in red and just two blockers in white. This is how relentless and swarming and how hungry that defense was. So if you want to make yesterday all about the Niners offense and the rushing attack, you can go right ahead. I can't blame you because it was that good, but do not sleep on that defense either because they're just as good. We know this. And the fact that this team went from 4-12 to the Super Bowl in 1 year is incredible. I know there were injuries last season, but at this time last season, this coaching staff was coaching the Senior Bowl. Now they're going to the Super Bowl. You coach the Senior Bowl if you're the worst team or one of the worst teams. From Mobile to Miami in a year is legendary. And the only thing more legendary would be winning it. And they might. And it would be no surprise if they did. They've got a brilliantly constructed roster, a genius young head coach who's pushing all the right buttons, and maybe even more importantly, leading from the front with a complete buy-in from everybody in that locker room. That is a badass football operation they're running in Santa Clara. I can't wait to see these guys on the big stage. Again, from the second pick in the 2019 draft to being one of two teams left for the Lombardi. It's incredible. What a great matchup. Hey, clones, the question of the day. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? I can tell you what we don't want. We don't want another bar or another sugary snack or another energy drink. No, instead we want beef, pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. It's not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. So it's tender and tasty. It's not tough. What makes it so good? I'm going to say it's the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. And Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. It's quality smoked meat at its finest, and it goes wherever you go. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're purchasing. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Dan Wojcicki. Dan, what's going on? How are you?
Jim, I feel like MMA is appropriate for me right now, because it felt like I got roundhouse kicked in the face the second I walk outside my hotel here in Boston today.
Love it. I hear you.
I heard you got punched pretty good in Kansas City, too.
Same deal, man. Much worse. And believe me, whatever you're dealing with right now, you're dealing with better than I dealt with yesterday. Trust that.
I would tell people it is, can I wear sweatpants underneath my suit pants cold?
Can I tell you something? Had I done that, I should have done that. Next time I will do that, because I wore nothing under my suit pants and it did not go well. Next time I will rock sweatpants under my suit pants, and I won't care, and I won't be too proud either. You know, right? Nobody cares how you look. It's how you feel, and you feel like crap right now, don't you?
Yeah, it's a little jarring, I'll say this. Plus, you can't buy, and you know this, like, you can't buy winter coats in California.
No, you can't find them. They're not for sale. And this is where everybody listening, Dan, says, oh, listen to those two punks, the two SoCal guys.
Yeah.
I don't care, man. I don't care. We were cold. You are cold. I was cold. I'm still cold, and I'm back home. So whatever.
I'm going to be cold, I think, in the mid-March.
There you go. Me too. All right, so you are in Boston for Lakers-Celtics tonight. Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, the Lakers are coming off a win in Houston where they held the Rockets to 17 in the third quarter. They beat the Rockets by 9 in a game where they did not have Anthony Davis. What do you make of their performance overall?
Well, I think they're able to do something. And look, everybody has tried different stuff against James Harden and to varying levels of success. And, you know, he's kind of rewritten what success looks like. Like, he can score 40 and you can still have a successful night against him just by making it really difficult. And I think what the Lakers did that I thought was really interesting, and keep in mind this was without Anthony Davis, is they used JaVale McGee and Dwight Howard to double-team James Harden. Because they have so much size and so much mobility, like, if JaVale McGee picks up two cheap fouls, it's like they've got Dwight Howard right there. You know, eventually they'll have Anthony Davis right there too. They're just so much bigger than everybody else. And I think Frank Vogel has done a really good job of deploying that size in different ways and seeing it against Houston, even using, you know, Kyle Kuzma and Russell Westbrook. I think that they did some really interesting stuff defensively, especially in that second half. And they're rolling right now. They're attacking the regular season with sort of a vigor that no one else in the NBA really is. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I haven't made up my mind yet, but, you know, they play hard as hell every time they step on the court. That's for sure.
Dan Wojcicki joining us. So what about that matchup? Like, Vogel, he obviously learned some things last night, and the coaching staff came out of it with a sense of knowing what they maybe can do or maybe can't do against Harden. But did they learn enough to know what they could do in a 7-game series against Harden, or is that still a work in progress?
I think it's still a work in progress, but I don't really get the sense, Jim, that teams are all that afraid of trying to figure out what to do against James Harden in a 7-game series. I think he's a lot easier to prepare for when you've got, you know, extended amount of time to kind of deal with it. And sort of, you know, his postseason record shows that. I think it's on him and the Houston Rockets at this point to kind of reverse that trend. This is a guy who, you know, shoots, his efficiency goes way down in the postseason. He gets the line less. He relies on the three-pointer more, and that's volatile. And I think when teams have days on days to scheme, sometimes 2 days off in between games, you know, you forget, like, most nights that James Harden steps on the court, he's playing a team that maybe has a practice, maybe has a walkthrough, you know, maybe even sometimes just film work. It's like teams don't actually get on the court and spend a lot of time scheming. The Lakers were able to do that before this game, so they were able to get 1 day of prep in. But you know, I think when you have multiple days to kind of go at him, I think the job gets a little easier. And I mean, there's a reason, I think, you know, for me at least, why I thought maybe Houston could have the best record in the West, but I never really considered them as a serious contender to win the West in the playoffs, just because I just think in the playoffs it's a different animal, and the way they play, it just seems a little easier to stop.
He is the national NBA writer for the Los Angeles Times. He is Dan Wojcicki. Dan, I never thought about Frank Vogel, for instance, when you take a step back, when he was hired, there was so much talk about how this guy's just not going to make it. He's not going to last. And it's only a matter of time before Jason Kidd is named head coach. As it stands, the Lakers have the best record in the West, and Vogel is a serious contender for coach of the year. What do you make of the job he's done with his team?
I mean, it's very Pete Carroll-esque, right? I mean, he's the third choice. You know, it wasn't even just that Jason Kidd would eventually be the guy. It's that, you know, it was going to be Monty Williams and it was going to be, you know, Ty Lue. Like, Ty Lue was, like, up to the finish line for this job. And, you know, obviously, I think he's done an incredible job. But the word that I keep hearing from people when I talk to him is detail. And it's the way that he's able to express what seemingly might seem like complex things and stuff like that. And he's able to kind of make it seem like it's not so difficult. And guys are on a nightly basis are able to kind of execute his schemes because they think they're not that hard, even though they might be a little complicated. They might be a little more sophisticated than they sound like. There's a simplicity to it, at least in the way he presents the information to his players. And I think, you know, he's done a really good job. And I'll say this too, credit to Rob Pelinka. I think the way that they kind of operated after Kawhi Leonard chose the Clippers, they moved briskly into another plan and they kind of swooped up the best of what was left. And then I think the most, you know, obviously the most underrated decision, not underrated, but maybe the biggest impact decision was, you know, they worked out other centers other than Dwight Howard. And I think a lot of people, myself included, thought a guy like Joakim Noah might even be a better fit. But, you know, talking to people, they said, no, look, we like Dwight. And part of the reason we like Dwight is that we know there are going to be nights when AD doesn't play. We know there are going to be nights when we need a little extra punch. And we think Dwight can give it to us. And they've been spot on with that decision. He's been a real difference maker.
Yeah, but Dan, what about that? Like, how did they know? Why did they know? Did the light just go off for Dwight Howard? What do you make of his resurrection?
I mean, I think you know, when faced with sort of the prospects of unemployment, I think that's certainly part of it. I mean,
that'll get your attention. You
know, yeah. People talk about rock bottom, and you know, he hasn't really specifically gone into sort of what it was that took him, you know, to sort of the depth where he was able to look at himself and make real changes. But you know, I think the Lakers were cautiously optimistic that those changes occurred. Obviously, they weren't sure. They gave him a non-guaranteed deal. But, you know, I mean, here we are more than halfway through the season and like he's beloved and that, you know what I mean? Him and Alex Caruso might be like the two most popular players outside of LeBron and AD at Laker games. He's a bench guy. He's an energy guy. He's the guy who does handshakes with everybody. He's up celebrating after every basket. He's been, you know, at least visibly such a good teammate. He's really rewritten his narrative and has probably bought himself an extra 5 or 6 years in the league because of it. It's been a pretty remarkable transformation.
That is awesome. That is so great. Dan, I do not play favorites. You know, they pay guys like you and me not to play favorites, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you who my two favorite Lakers are right now. Caruso and Howard, in that order. Then LeBron, then AD.
The Caruso thing is
awesome.
I mean, obviously, it's you've got this balding, thinly mustachioed white guy who's 25, who looks like he's like Schneider, you know, from, I don't even remember that show. I don't know. That's a half baked
one day at a time.
One day at a time.
Right.
He looks a little
I got you.
Like Schneider. And it's like, here he is. And he's just going to yam on you too. Right. Like, I mean, he's always looking for dunks. He's always looking for energy plays. You know, he's been a really, really nice bench piece, a good player too. And I think the Lakers did a good job kind of finding him through sort of their tank period, you know, 2 years ago, like getting him into their system, into their G League system and having him as a two-way player and then obviously rewarding him with a contract this year. And Tim, it just goes to show that like when you do have superstars like LeBron and AD, it can lead to really clear role definition for everybody else. There's such an obvious hierarchy. It's like Alex Caruso isn't trying to get, you know, LeBron shots or AD shots. Like he knows his job. And this is a Lakers team that's full of players that know their jobs. And I think that's another thing that Frank Vogel deserves a lot of credit for, and Rob Pelinka, is that they've surrounded these guys with role players. You know, nobody is out there trying to earn an next contract. I mean, maybe that's part of the reason the Kuzma stuff hasn't been exactly like a perfect fit. But we've seen without AD, you know, he's very comfortable stepping in and taking shots and becoming a primary scorer on this team too. So the roster's really been pretty expertly put together.
Dan Woerke, my guest. Not only is Caruso my favorite Laker, he might be the best basketball player I've ever seen, literally. And I'm not being – that's not hyperbole either. I love this guy. Dan, one last thought. And you and I could spend a lot of time on this, but if I just took kind of one shot at this, you did a piece in the LA Times on the Clippers recently, and if you were to go back to when LeBron James and Chris Bosh joined Dwayne Wade in Miami, the thinking was it would take a year for teams to kind of get on the same page no matter how much talent they have. Given that track record, how well are the Clippers meshing so far in your mind?
I think it's gone okay. I don't think it's been great. I think the biggest thing that they've had to kind of come to terms with is the team that they were last year, right? The team that was sort of like this bulldog, hard-nosed team that was like an underdog every night and could play like – the imagery that always comes to my mind is they play like a team that was like somebody was trying to drown, right? Like when you'll flail and kick and you'll do all this stuff just to make sure you can get your next breath. Like that's how they played last year. They don't have to do that this year. You know, most nights they're going to have the best player on the court. A lot of nights when they're fully healthy, they might have the best three or four. They're so talented and they're so deep. They have just been sort of, I think, a lax attitude because of it. They haven't recaptured the same urgency as they had a year ago. You know, will it come in the playoffs? I don't know. I mean, I would say Kawhi Leonard has earned enough trust to say, like, when the lights go on, like, that dude will flip the switch. He's ready. In the playoffs, but, you know, can you bring everybody else with them? It remains to be seen. They've been okay, Jim. It feels like they've underachieved, but, like, you put their record up right against where the Raptors were last year, it's almost identical.
He is in Boston for the Lakers and Celtics this evening. He is the national NBA writer for the LA Times. My man, Dan Woerke. Dan, keep warm. Keep warm. Good to have
you
back.
Jim. I'm going to go find a parka.
So let's talk MMA right now ahead of that. New topic. UFC 246. Conor v. Cowboy. Conor McGregor looking for his first win in the octagon in more than 3 years, going up against one of the tougher guys that you're ever going to find, even in that sport. So how would that go? Well, to quote the man himself from back in the day, surprise, surprise, mother bleeper, the king is back.
Surprise, motherfucker, the king is back.
We can debate whether or not the king is back, but that was impressive. I mean, like, how would that go? It would go quickly, really quickly. Not quite Jose Aldo quickly, but not much longer than that. 40 seconds of extreme violence, and then it was over.
Tonight's fight clock is brought to you by Modelo. Brewed for those with a fight experience. Cerrone in blue, Conor McGregor with a couple early shoulder strikes in green.
Conor with a big shot to start this off. Oh, bleeding.
And
it might be from the
shoulder.
Yeah.
Get out of here with that.
Just like that. If you saw the fight or you've seen a replay of the fight, the only thing that would have made it even better or more impressive than that, Conor ran across the cage looking to land that giant left. Came out firing immediately. If that thing had connected and landed, that would have been the most spectacular thing ever. And he tried. But it didn't go, it missed. But it didn't go much longer than that. So Conor goes into the cage with a plan, and that plan was to leave that cage as quickly as possible after causing as much damage as possible. And give everybody something to talk about. He missed with that huge left to start, but then he clinched with Cowboy Cerrone, and he broke out a new weapon, his shoulder. And he used it and appeared to break the Cowboy's nose. If you were surprised by that, you were not alone. So was Cowboy. Cowboy said, quote, 100%, it surprised me. I've never seen anything like that, end quote. Neither had I. And then Conor smashed him with a left kick, and moments later, it was over. So much for cage rust. Conor knocked off all the rust in seconds and nearly knocked Cowboy's head off his shoulders a few seconds later. And for all the questions about how Conor would show up, his performance answered some, but it did raise a couple as well. Like, how do you explain a guy coming back from that much time off and coming back with a new weapon? That's pretty impressive. That might not have been his best fight ever. I'm not saying that. Notice I'm not coming in here and hyping this guy and saying, the king is back, the king is back. That was amazing. I've never seen anything like it. It was really impressive. And he looked good. He looked really good. But I'm not going to say that was his finest moment or his best fight. Because nobody's going to confuse Cowboy at this point in his career with Khabib or Masvidal. or the other elites. He's tough, and he's a savvy vet. Although there were a lot of questions coming in about how Cowboy would do on the big stage because he never fares well on the big stage and then didn't again. But this guy's solid now. Very tough and a very good fighter. And Connor just went right through him, took him apart. Both with his skills and with his cage savvy and with his strategy. So again, I'm not going to be all over myself saying that was the best he's ever looked. That was another legendary Connor moment. But it certainly was a Connor moment. And he put everybody on notice, which includes any fighter that wants any part of him, because everybody does, because he gets everybody paid.
Anyone it is that Melody Fills can get it, even that little Phil at the desk, all of them, every single one of them can get a job. It does not matter. We're back and I'm ready. Look at that Phil in his blade and house coat there, stupid tick. Congratulations, sir, on a spectacular.
He also went on about anybody. Anybody and anybody who has a, quote, made-up belt. Quote, they can give fighters made-up belts, but they can't give fighters knockouts across three weight divisions. End of quote. Connor's done that now. You know, what do you think about Connor at 170? Do you buy that? Can the guy... It's one thing to win at 170, but it's another to beat the elite and the best at 170. I still have that question. But then again, Connor has his own questions. Something for those analysts who questioned his skill set.
The so-called experts of the game, when they'd be breaking down my skill set, they'd be saying I'm just a fighter with a left hand, which is highly disrespectful and uneducated. I knew he was planning to knock me out with a head kick. I knew he wanted to everyone, oh, what if Donald catches the head kick and all this? I knew this was what Donald would have been envisioning. But at the same time, I noticed Donald has many discrepancies in leans and dips and under certain attacks that can also set him up for the high kick. So the high kick was something I thought I could catch him with also. Look, I spent so much time in my boxing gym. I went back to my roots, Crumlin boxing, where I began. And what happens tonight? I smack him with my shoulder and smack him with my foot.
Man, he's good. Even when he's not saying anything, he's still good. So what happened tonight? I smacked him with me shoulder, and I smacked him with me foot. And how do you explain a guy looking that good after everything he's done to himself over the last few years? Part of it is about the booze. I love this. He admitted part of his problem was the booze. Quote, I love that whiskey, but you've got to respect it. You've got to respect that liquid, because if you don't, it will come and get you. End quote. You know, I've gone on and on about Conor McGregor and how he's like the greatest showman I think I've ever seen in sports. The greatest smack runner I've ever seen in sports. And I want to temper that by saying he has said some pretty abhorrent things. Like, I can't get with everything he says. Far from it. When he's good and he's just talking junk for junk's sake, that's fine. But when he goes racist and talks about some of this other nonsense, that's not fine at all. But when he's clean, he's good. And when he owns things, he's good. Quote, you've got to respect that liquid, because if you don't, it will come and get you. He's talking about the sauce, the whiskey. So the story's about him hitting the sauce hard before the Khabib fight. That's all true, right? How is it possible that he was able to step into the cage with his most dangerous opponent, and he was drinking all week? This is what he's saying. That, to me, still doesn't even make sense. I mean, it's one thing for you to hit the sauce too hard before a really important event in your life. It's another thing to hit the sauce if that event includes another guy trying to break your face. That, to me, is unfathomable. But that's exactly what he says he did.
I achieved it all, right? I broke the game before I was 30 years of age. Simple as one belt's almost not even enough anymore. You got to get the two to even start earning it big style. So maybe that. I achieved it all. John always says the worst, my coach says it's the worst nightmare for a coach if his student achieves it all. The money, the fame, the belts, all of this. What then to motivate me?
See what I mean? When the guy's just being Connor and he's being straight, he's so interesting. He's so fascinating. He admitted it. He said, I'm a coach's worst nightmare. What do you do when you break the game before you're 30 and you've achieved everything? Dana White and I talked about this literally for months. What do you do when you have $100 million? What do you do when you had nothing and then suddenly you have everything? Where is the incentive to continue to work? Connor admitted it. I'd done these amazing things and I stopped putting in the work. Then he realized it. Then he came back and he looked great. So the question becomes, who does he fight next? If in fact the king is back and he's holding the hammer once again, who does he fight next? Is it Khabib or is it somebody else?
Nate Diaz tweeted out right after the fight calling it weak as f***. I don't know if that was in reference to Donald's performance or just the fight in general. You know, what's your response to that? And is he anywhere on your list of potential opponents?
Let's go, Nathan. Let's go, brother. Number three. It's always here. So we're right here, Nathan.
Nathan. He Nathaned him. Not me, Nate. I got you, Nate. I love Nate Diaz. I love Nate Diaz. I don't know. I mean, is it Nate Diaz? Dana White was saying it's Khabib. You can make an argument that Masvidal, who is our guest on the podcast this week, Jorge Masvidal. Man, I love Masvidal. This guy, the resurrection, game bred. I mean, I want to say that he's too big for Conor. But then again, we are talking about the two baddest dudes in the sport. And I, you know, I would say, and no offense, Nate. I think Nate is one of the baddest mothers anywhere. But Masvidal got him. But if you're Conor, what do you do next? If you're Dana White, who do you make him fight? Well, actually, you can't make Conor do anything, right? We know this. But what's next? I'm not sure. Because I'm not sure that anybody expected a performance like that. Coming back, dominating, finishing it as quickly as he did, and breaking out the shoulder strikes. What happened Saturday night in the cage does not erase everything that's happened outside of the cage. But for the first time in a long time, what we have are good Conor headlines, the right headlines. Again, I'm not saying that that means he's back as a fighter. I'm not saying that that means that was his best fight or most impressive performance. It was neither of those things. But when you consider the layoff, when you consider how long it's been since he last won, when you consider the obstacles that he put in his own path, man, that was impressive as hell. If that's not the full Conor McGregor in the cage, it's a damn good reminder. It doesn't mean that he can beat the other guys I mentioned. It doesn't mean he's back. And while no fighter is bigger than this sport is a hell of a lot better when McGregor is not running dollies through buses, punching old men in bars, not respecting the liquid, and getting accused of other heinous stuff. You know, he may have a point. Point being, the king might be back. Now we have to wait and see what he does next, who he fights next. But that was damn good to see. Really enjoyed that. And I respected it. What's next? Who do you want to see him fight? Conor's been saying, I want to fight three times this year, which would be awesome. He was on last week, and he's back on this week. He is Kevin Ioli. Kevin, good to have you. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. It's been too long. It's only, what, 2 days?
Right. It's been a long time, Kevin. I had to run you down. In fact, before we talk about Saturday, let's get into Sunday. You went golfing yesterday. Where did you play? How was your round? How have you been hitting them?
Well, Las Vegas Paiute Resort, which I think is one of the best courses in Vegas, three Pete Dye courses. I have a membership there. I played. Nine holes, wasn't bad. I shot 39. I've been in a bad slump, so I was happy about that.
You got yourself a pretty nice stick there, Kevin. All right, then. 39, three over. Well done. All right, so you and I did talk on Friday about UFC 246, and it is rare, Kevin, that somebody comes right back on the program. But then again, what we saw Saturday night was pretty rare as well. What kind of questions did you have about how Conor McGregor would look and perform on Saturday night coming in?
Well, you know, the thing you didn't know is he hadn't fought in 15 months. He hadn't won in, you know, 3.5 years. What's his timing going to be like? What's his commitment? Is he really, you know, he looked good at the weigh-in, but that doesn't always tell how you're going to fight. And so you just had all those questions in your mind. Is this guy going to be the dominant force that he was? You know, I don't think he was ever the pound-for-pound best in the world. That was always John Jones and Demetrius Johnson in my mind. But he was up there as one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world in his previous incarnation. Now, you know, he lost to Floyd Mayweather. He lost to Khabib. What kind of guy is he going to be? That was really what we had to look for on Saturday night. What Conor would we get?
Now, Kevin, one thing we know about Connor, at least in the past, we know that he can start quickly. We know that Cowboy has had some slow starts in the past. But even knowing those two things, what kind of a fight were you expecting? For instance, were you expecting a 40-second knockout?
Oh, God, no, no, no. I mean, I wasn't surprised it was a first or second round finish because with these two guys, that's the kind of fight you would expect. I just thought that you would see Cowboy put up a little bit more. But he really got blitzed, and I think what happened is Connor keeps shooting out of the corner and threw that left hand at the beginning. And Cowboy, even though he ducked underneath it, he never got set and got recovered. So Connor fought way faster pace than I expected him to do, Jim. I mean, if you look at that, when the bell sounded, he sprints across and he throws a left hand at Cowboy. Cowboy ducks under it, and then Connor's right back at him with those shoulders. Excuse me. And that, to me, was the turning point of the fight, just how fast he started.
Kevin Ioli, my guest. Kevin, it's not like we haven't seen it before, right? He iced Jose Aldo with that same left hand, but when he came out with that left hand on Saturday night, all I could think to myself is if that thing landed, I mean, how dramatic this would be right now. But then, to our point, he did get him 38 seconds later. Cowboy said he was completely surprised by the shoulder strikes from Connor. What do you make of those and the impact they had on Cowboy?
I think that was so creative on his part, and that's the thing about MMA. You can use every part of your body to strike somebody, to beat somebody. And very thoughtful and creative on Connor's part. He got in that clinch inside, and, you know, most of the time you expect when you're in that clinch you're going to throw a knee. Instead of throwing the knee, which I think Cowboy would have been prepared for, Connor comes back with that shoulder. And I think, you know, everything played into it. You know, the missed left hand had Cowboy off balance. Then the shoulders come in. I don't think it hurt him like a punch would have hurt him, but he was woozy. You know, he broke his nose, and those were two very hard strikes. And so he's a little bit woozy, and he's trying to, you know, get his equilibrium. You want to try to create distance and get back so you can reset. And Connor just never gave him time to get reset, and his head was a little bit fuzzy. And so I think it was one of those things. Connor could not have fought a more perfect fight.
Kevin Ioli joining us. Now, no matter what, Kevin, the fact that he came back meant that there were going to be options. But like you just said, he could not have fought a more perfect fight. So now we know he has options, lots of options. Dana White has talked in the past about how he does not like Connor fighting at 170 because he gives up too much weight to his opponent. But after that fight, he was so impressive that Dana said, I'm not going to bring that up again. I'm not going to talk about him fighting at 170. That said, in your opinion, what is the optimum weight for Connor? What's his best weight?
I really think 155 is his best weight. I mean, when you start talking about some of the, you know, Cowboy Cerrone's a guy that's fought down in weight. And even though he's bigger now, you know, Cowboy's not a huge welterweight. Some of these guys at welterweight are massive. And I think it's, you know, and especially if they're wrestlers like the champion, Kamaru Usman, that becomes a tough matchup for him. So, you know, I think that's an issue. You even look at this, go back when he was in his prime 3 years to when he fought Nate Diaz. Diaz was the bigger guy with him, and he had trouble with Nate Diaz in both of those fights. Even the fight he won, you know, he wasn't able to knock Diaz out. Diaz came back and just kept coming and coming and coming, and Diaz was the one coming on at the end of that fight. So, you know, size is a big factor in MMA. There's no question when you combine it with skill. And I think, you know, Kamaru Usman is one of the guys that would be difficult. If he could beat Kamaru Usman, I mean, he is going to make himself, if he's not a legend already, he's going to be an utter legend.
Kevin Ioli is joining us once again, and he's not the only one, right? Like Dana White said last week when he came on this show, that Connor really wants the rematch with Habib. At the same time, Habib is already facing Tony Ferguson in April at UFC 249. Ramadan starts the Thursday after that fight, so the thinking would be that Khabib would not be ready for the fight until next fall or until the fall.
Right.
Connor's talked about fighting a number of times this year. I mean, if you had to guess, Kevin, how do you think this whole thing shakes out?
Well, I think Dana's going to really try to convince him to wait. Connor seems to want to fight Usman. He said, I'd like to see the welterweight title fight. The fight that makes the most sense to me, Jim, would be Masvidal. And I think they could get Masvidal in there. Connor had talked before this fight, if he got out of there quickly and wasn't hurt, you know, coming back in March, there's a show in Vegas that's going to be headlined by Israel Adesanya. Well, maybe now that could be headlined by Conor McGregor again against Jorge Masvidal. there's a fight. You know, Masvidal was a 155er who's now up at 170, just won the BMF title. That would be a huge fight that people would really be into. And then you put him on a closer track with Habib, and you're still going to get at least three fights out of him, where if Habib beats Tony Ferguson, like you say, he's going to be out probably until September time frame. Bingo, that brings Conor right back in that perfect thing. So I think they should consider bringing him back quickly for a fight with Masvidal. But Dana seemed adamant because, and I agree with him on this point. I said to him before the fight, I asked him, hey, I think a Habib-Conor rematch would do more than 3 million on pay-per-view. That would be the number three pay-per-view of all time and the number one UFC pay-per-view of all time. And he agreed with me. And then, in fact, at the press conference Saturday, he said over 4 million. So he's thinking that that's such a big fight, he doesn't want to blow it by having Conor potentially lose in the interim.
All right, so, Kevin, in addition to that, Conor said after the fight, quote, I love that whiskey, but you've got to respect it. You've got to respect that liquid, because if you don't, it will come back and get you. Thinking being that he didn't respect it before the Habib fight, and that fight went really badly for him. If there is, in fact, a rematch, and Conor's dialed in, and he's not drinking, and he's locked in, how do you see the rematch going with Habib? How different would it be than the first fight?
I find it difficult to believe that Conor could beat him, but I think he could make it a more compelling fight. Look, you know, he had his moments in that first fight. There's no doubt. And I said this to you on Friday, but, you know, you look at the fight with Habib, and Conor was not at his best, and he did pretty good defending the grappling, you know, and he went into the fourth round. And, I mean, look what happened to Dustin Poirier, a terrific fighter, and he just got mauled and was submitted in the second round in their fight. So I think, you know, Conor, you know, I don't think he beats him, and I don't even really see a scenario where I could come out and say, yeah, I think Conor could cover enough ground. But, you know, you never know, and he has that punching power. The one thing we know with Conor, those fast hands, he catches you on the chin, and he can end a fight in a hurry. And that is always something that's, you know, it's kind of like Earl Weaver used to say about the three-run homer. The same thing in the fight game is that knockout power that Conor brings.
Kevin Ioli joining me for a few more moments. And, of course, Kevin, there's noise from Floyd Mayweather about a possible rematch with McGregor. Conor says that Floyd is going through money fast. He's far from retired. That rematch will happen. That's a direct quote from Conor. Given Dana White's relationship with Floyd, how likely is it that that fight happens at some point?
You know, I would say less than 50-50, but I wouldn't totally rule it out. I think what is the most likely scenario with Floyd Mayweather is for Zuffa Boxing to be created in the summer and to have Pacquiao versus Mayweather promoted by Dana White as the debut of Zuffa Boxing. So have that fight happen, you know, sometime later this year. Have Conor fight either Habib or Masvidal. I think to me that's where we'll see Dana and Floyd have some kind of an understanding. I don't know if they have a signed contract, but they do have some kind of an understanding. They met at a Clippers game, and that Floyd is going to do business with them. So I think that's more likely than a Conor fight. I wouldn't rule it out because Conor wants it, and Dana generally does what Conor wants because Conor has done so much for the company. But I think more likely is a Pacquiao-Mayweather rematch.
Kevin, what about from a fan standpoint? I know exactly what you're saying with Conor. I know why Conor would want that fight. There's a lot of money to be made off that fight. From a fan standpoint, how interested would you be in seeing that fight again?
Very little. I wasn't interested in the first one. You know, I mean, I knew what would happen. If it was an MMA fight, Conor would have beaten him in 15 seconds. If it was a boxing match, you know, Floyd was going to drum him. And that's what we saw, and that's what would happen again. You know, the only intrigue in a rematch would be the fact that Floyd would be years old and wouldn't have fought in, you know, close to 3 years. We don't know when it would happen because he fought Conor in August of 17. We're in 20 now. So, you know, that would be the only intrigue in the fight is, and people, you know, the people who don't like Floyd desperately want to see him lose. So that would be the big intrigue in the fight. Can he finally lose? But he's 43 years old and hasn't fought in 3 years. But, Jim, I just don't see it. That's a lot of ground for a guy in a second pro fight to cover in a boxing match against somebody like Floyd Mayweather. And I just don't see that happening.
Kevin, one last thought. What about Masvidal? I love Masvidal. I'm amazed by the 2019 that he had and the fact that he had gone away for a while and he kind of reinvented himself. He talks about the resurrection. He is a fascinating figure to me. What did he do exactly while he was away, and what do you make of the way he came back in the year he had?
Well, I think, you know, he got away from it because he was bouncing between weight classes, wasn't sure really what he wanted to do. He went on a reality show in the Dominican Republic, And when he came back, you know, he made himself into a complete mixed martial artist. You know, he had wrestling skills, but you know, he didn't fully develop those. Now he has everything you want in a fighter. He's got submissions. Obviously, he's a great striker. He's got a good chin. He's got the wrestling game. And he went out there and he showed against Darren Till, who's one of the top middleweights in the world right now. He knocked Darren Till out. And I mean, he really hurt him and beat him up. Showed a good chin in that fight because he got knocked down, got up off the ground. Masvidal is a fascinating guy, and I think he is going to make a ton of money this year because there are so many people that want to fight him. And I wouldn't rule out a rematch later this year with Nate Diaz if he gets the Conor fight. That's going to be huge. And I think he's put himself into that position. I don't want to call him an Arturo Gatti type because I think they're different styles of fighters, but everybody wanted to fight Arturo Gatti because they wanted to get into that kind of crazy fight. And I think that that's what they're going to want to have with Masvidal.
Let's go this time to Crescent City. Trapper. Trapper, what's going on?
Hey, Jimmy, how you doing? Greetings on Dr. King's Day. Keep the faith in his spirit, my brother. We need it now more than ever. As you know, I'm battling cancer. Right now, I think there's a bigger one, Jim, and it's killing our national pastime, talking about the Astros using sophisticated high-tech spyware to steal signs, which led them to winning the 2017 series and the 2019 ACLS. And a lot more if you look at it. Yeah, banging on garbage cans sounds funny, but there is evolving proof that Houston's Altuve and Alex Bregman took it a step further with electronic monitors taped under their jerseys. The fact that the MLB has already punished Cora, who else? Carlos Beltran and AJ Hinch for their involvement, it shows you the allegations are true, Jim. The fact that the punishments were so soft and inflicted upon only those three, it makes Manfred complicit in it, and he ought to be fired. Also complicit was, this is when to start, when Mike Fears actually woke up with a conscience. This was last November, and he went public to Kenny Rosenthal because this was horrible. He wanted to protect the game's integrity. First thing, what does he get? A snitches get stitches attack from ESPN analyst and Mets advisor, Jessica Mendoza. Jess, what was your last job? With the Gotti family? Or were you just rustling the sheets with Sammy the Bull? What's really sickening, Jimmy, here is how deep the ramifications go. This isn't just about stealing signs and people striking out or hitting home runs. From winning games to ruining records and salary bargaining positions and so much more. And even more nauseating for me, Jim, they had Fan Fest on Saturday, 2 days ago. The fact that Altuve and Bregman had the unmitigated gall to even show up and look adoring kids in the faces while bald-faced dodging any questions about their involvement, it goes to nauseating. I'll finish it up with Mendoza, fire. Manfred, fire him. Altuve and Bregman, anybody else shown to have received notice a la trash can thumping, 1 year suspension and forfeit, 17 pay. If they wore buzzers, the death penalty. For the 17 Strohs, return all rings, series pay, what else? So forfeit the series championship. And since Curt Schilling, who's up for the Hall this year, there's those that want to keep him out because of his racist, homophobic, what else? Misogynistic and bigoted rhetoric. Heck, even the right-wing scum at Breitbart canned him. That said, his bona fides off the field, that might get him into hell, Jim. His ones on the field, that's enough to get him in. Enough said. Last, and I want to say this with the deepest respect and admiration to Sherry Redstone and Viacom, a belated congratulations on pulling the trigger on the merger with CBS. Welcome to the jungle, Sherry. A bucket full of jungle karma for your tenacity and character. We love you, babe. That's all I got, Jimmy. Happy Doc's Day, and let his spirit come across our country. God bless you. Tramps like us, babe. I'm out.
Tramps like us. Rack that call, Alvin. Trapper still bringing the heat.
Good night!